We're just having a discussion over here about harmful influences for children, such as types of movies and TV programs, etc. What is the criteria on which a parent who's concerned about the impact on the child, what are the criteria which would determine whether it's a harmful influence? It's not easy to answer that question. And in general, if there's a specific content, a specific message, which will resonate with the child and make an impact in the unconscious and will be reawakened when the child becomes an adult, then that would be harmful. That is to say, for example, I'll show you the positive side. We're supposed to do a certain amount of education in terms of creating an impact on the unconscious. Because Chazal, the rabbis, say that when a child is very young, may not understand the ideas of the Shabbos, but already you can educate the child by giving the child pleasant things on the Shabbos. So that already in the unconscious, there is a pleasant association between Shabbos and when Shabbos comes. Now that in and of itself, obviously, is not going to guarantee that the child will be observant of Shabbos just because of that experience. No one intends that. So if that's the case, then what's the point? Whether or not the child will be observant is going to be dependent upon many, many, many factors. At this point in time, the child doesn't even have choice. When they're that young, they don't have real thought. And the child is going to develop into a different kind of a being in which they're going to have to make a decision. So it just does not lie within the scheme of things for the individual to have the ability to do anything that would guarantee the outcome. It's interesting, I spoke about this this past Friday night. There was a community Shabbos dinner because they welcomed the new principal of the school. So I was one of the speakers. And I gave over the idea, well, first of all, that everything in Judaism is really ideas. It's really learning. And I showed that the philosophy of Jewish education is really in tefillah. I quoted from one of the Mefarshim on the Otzer HaTefilos the issue of why it says Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Why does it say God of Yitzchak and God of Yaakov when in point of fact, it only should be God of Avraham? As the Rambam explains, that the world was steeped in idolatry, and Avraham, utilizing his own mind, discovered the truth. And therefore, all the ideas pertaining to what we mean when we identify God, it's all from Avraham. And then Avraham, of course, had Yitzchak, and he transmitted it to Yitzchak. And Yitzchak transmitted it to Yaakov, but you can't say the same thing, it would seem, anyways, that it should just be Elokei Avraham. It should just be the God of Avraham. Everybody else got it from Avraham. I'm going to be quoting to you now from a Pirush called the Eitz Yosef on one of the commentaries on the Siddur known as the Otzer HaTefilos. And the way he phrases it is as follows. It says Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, and Elokei Yaakov. So he says that the reason why that we say Elokei, why do we mention God of? It would have three times. By each one we mention Elokei. It could have simply said one time Elokei Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It could have simply said the God of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So he's phrasing the question that way. I framed it when I learned this slightly differently, and according to the way I had the question, it should have merely said God of Avraham. Not God of our fathers, God of our father, Avraham. Because Yitzchak and Yaakov simply received it from him. He's basically getting at the same thing, but he's not objecting to the inclusion of Yitzchak and Yaakov, but merely the fact that it mentions God of three times. So his answer is, it is in line with the idea that we find in Divrei Hayamim. That's in Perek 28, Pasuk 9, where David said to Shlomo, V'ata Shlomo b'ni, and now my son Shlomo, da et Elokei Avicha, know the God of your father, v'avduhu, and serve him. So that is a very, very powerful statement. In one pasuk alone, you have the entire philosophy of Yahadus. Which means to say, avduhu is serve him. But you can't serve him without a precondition. There's a prior condition, and that is da, to know the God of your fathers. Now let me continue with his pirush. He says the simple pshat is, she'ein la'odam lahamin beloka mitzad minag avosav. Boy, this is powerful stuff. It's good to know the source, and I doubt that this philosophy is being taught anywhere in the Jewish world today, in the yeshiva world. He said it is not correct, it is not right for a person to believe in God because it is the tradition of his fathers. Kizen minoka umos olam, because that's the custom of the Gentiles. Ela mitzad chakira al pi torasenu hakadosha, but rather one should serve God on the one should believe in God on the basis of inquiry into our holy Torah, shehu keil, that he is God, habore, the creator, yisbarach v'yisal ha-shemo, may his name be blessed and exalted. Therefore it says, da es Elokei Avicha, mitzad hachakira. That's why David said, know the God of your father. See, because in a sense, it's a bit of a ambivalence, or even a contradiction. Because if it's the God of your father, so then it's not da. The two contradict each other. In other words, either you're accepting God because that's your father, so it means it was just passed down on to you. So that's not da. That's not no. Therefore, he says, no. Mitzara hakira. That you should come to recognize and to know the God of your father, but the medium has to be through inquiry. Umatsinu bi Avram, and we find by Avram, Shuho yechoker rishon, elokuso, that he was the first to inquire into God. Vehu hodia elokuso ba'olam, and he made known God's divinity in the world. Kiviyamav hayu ovdim the kachavim umazalos, because in his time they were worshipping the stars and other spheres, planetary beings. Now he gets back to answer his question. V'im hayinu amrim Elokei Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov, and if I would have said God of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov hayisi omer, I would have thought, had the Shemoneh Esrei said that, I would have thought Avram hayachoker rishon, that Avram was the original thinker. Yeah, so that would have implied that Avram was the first inquirer. And Yitzchak and Yaakov, his sons, simply relied on the emuna of their father. So, if it would have said, okay, Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov, so it would only have mentioned Elokei with regard to Avraham, then you would have, all it would tell you was that, yeah, Avram was the one who discovered, he was the thinker. And the others, they received it from him. L'kacharu omrim Elokei eitz el kolecha v'yachad. That's why we use the expression Elokei by each one. K'dei lodia, in order to teach, shekol echad mitzar atzmo amad al hachakira. Because each one on his own utilized the methodology of chakira, of inquiry. Umatza, and discovered she'ein echad el Elokeinu, that there's no one except for our God. V'hu chizik emunasa hakdosha, and that's the strengthening of our holy emuna. So I wanted to explain that herein lies the whole educational philosophy of Judaism, that the first educator is really Avraham. And once he had Yitzchak. He had a individual to whom he wanted to transmit. He wanted, the whole objective was to perpetuate the Judaism. So essentially, he had to make a decision what the methodology would be. And all religions, any kind of a system, but especially religion, that desires to perpetuate itself, has to establish a methodology whereby it does so. Now, the one that's chosen, by and large, I would say by virtually every religion, is what I would call indoctrination, which is not education, indoctrination. And the reason why they choose that is because, superficially, it's the most effective. They want to guarantee that it'll be passed on and accepted in every generation, and they want to eliminate, to the greatest extent possible, any possibilities for deviation. The essential feature of indoctrination is that you don't question. To the contrary, you inculcate the idea, brainwashing, you inculcate the idea into the child at a very early age, and you sort of protect it by building a wall of guilt around that concept. That's something that just can't be questioned. It's something you must accept. You appeal to the most powerful emotions in the child, and the child, of course, is a victim. In this case, I'll use a strong term. The child is being raped. The mind of the child is being raped. It's an intellectual rape. That's what religion does. So that's the choice that one has to make. What will be the method of perpetuation? The method of indoctrination. Now, we could try a bit to understand why Avraham rejected it. You see from Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, that Avraham rejected this idea. But let's ask ourselves why. I mean, it really works. You could see that Christianity, Islam, it doesn't, when you're utilizing this method, then the content of the religion, whether the ideas, the substance, whether they make any sense or not, or even if they're absurd, it would seem that this is such a powerful tool that the most absurd ideas can be transmitted from one generation to the next. It doesn't matter how crazy the ideas are. That is how vulnerable the mind is, the mind of the child. That's why you see that today, I mean, people would find this hard to believe. Of course, people would get offended. And they would say that, that's because I don't like the ideas of other religions. That's why I'm saying that. But these ideas are really either good or they're not bad, they're not terrible. No, but take a look today, you see, with the radical Islamists, and they inculcate, even in the children, in kindergartens, when they're very, very young, the crazy ideas about martyrdom and paradise, and that if you blow yourself up and you kill Jews in the process, so you go to heaven. All of these ideas are absolutely absurd. Any intelligent person couldn't even take them seriously. And yet, you see, not only do people believe them, but they actually live according to them. These ideas are so powerful that they overpower the person's instinct of self-preservation. So how is that possible? You see that there's a tremendous vulnerability. In the human makeup, in the human constitution, but especially so when the mind of the child is totally undeveloped and it's helpless. That's why I use the term rape, because the victim is absolutely helpless and you have complete control, and it has the effect, it's worse than rape, because a person can recover from that. It's virtually impossible for a person to recover from this. Of course, the question is, but okay, that's something to be rejected because the content is false. But what about if the content is true? If it's true religion and the objective is to perpetuate it, and this is a very effective kind of a tool and a method, so why did Avraham reject this method? The answer is that it goes to the heart of what Judaism is, and the essence of Judaism is the truth, is knowledge of God, the perfection of man, which comes about through the utilization of his understanding and the power of free will, of bechira. he must choose that which is good on the basis of his knowledge and understanding. And by utilizing this method, you rob him of that opportunity. To the extent that it is something which is embedded in the mind, which he just accepts automatically without even questioning, to that extent, you're depriving him of the opportunity to make the choice. So, in the guise of doing something which appears to be good for him, in point of fact, you're not really doing anything good. You're harming the person because he'll never, ever be able to relate to this truth in the proper way, in a manner so that it'll have the effect of the perfection that it's supposed to bring about. We're just getting into a discussion over here as to what we mean by our terms. Those who are disagreeing with me with this view were extolling what is referred to as emuna pshuta, which means plain emuna, simple emuna, which clearly is as distinct from chakira, as distinct from intellectual inquiry, where the mind arrives at certain conclusions because of the logic of the phenomena, because of its understanding of the phenomena. It's something which is arrived at by the mind. When people say that they've been searching, they weren't religious, in fact they were very irreligious, and they've gone through so many changes, and suddenly they discovered some religion, whether it be Christianity, for Christians it becomes Jesus, they're born again. You have the same phenomenon with Jews too, that the people become Baal Tshuva. They return. And they'll say that they went through so many different things in life, and they finally discovered it's Judaism. You have to go into it a bit deeper. Just because they use the word discovered does not necessarily mean that it's through drisha v'chakira, through a real intellectual inquiry. It could still be emuna pshuta, which would be simplistic type of belief. Very often it means that when they were younger, they were pursuing certain instincts, certain fantasies, and so on. And as normally happens when people do that, they very often experience tremendous disappointments. Either because they don't attain what they want, or what could be even worse, they do attain it, and they're completely disillusioned, disappointed. Or because they get into a crazy kind of a lifestyle, which brings with it unanticipated consequences. So they could wind up on drugs and other craziness, and they get divorced 4 times, and they have a messed up life, and or a tremendous sense of emptiness. So that's what propels people to look for a certain thing called meaning. Meaning is very important to the human being. It's something which is an essential element of human existence. Man is the only creature that needs meaning. There is no other creature that could even relate to the term, to the word, meaning. But every one of us knows, due to the fact that we're human, that we must have meaning. A person can't live without meaning. Lo ha'alechem levado yichyeh ha'adam. That is to say that man doesn't live by bread alone. Which means that if you just take care of the physical necessities of a person, they can't live. They've just got too much energy. And the energy is striving for something, and it's above and beyond, and it has to have, they have to feel a certain fulfillment, a certain purpose. For a human being to feel that he's purposeless, that his life has no purpose, is a tremendous existential disaster for the person. So everybody is searching for meaning. Of course, it's amazing what types of things a person can concoct in order to render it into something that has meaning. A man is very good at that. He is tremendously imaginative and inventive in projecting. He projects. The thing is that either there really is meaning, which is very rare. I mean, true meaning, true purpose. Or it's something which is invented and projected onto something which has absolutely no meaning. An example of projecting meaning onto something which has no meaning would be the way we idolize actors, actresses, sports heroes. That is to say, people have skills and they're capable of doing different types of maneuvers, playing different types of games, but essentially it's just a game. And the level of meaning that it has, in the scheme of things, is minute. But due to the fact that there's powerful feelings, it's invested. You see, when they talk about heroes, sports heroes, they utilize the same type of terms that they use when they describe really important figures in history. Real meaning would be, in reality, it's not that complicated a thing. It's just that when people are searching for things, they're searching for those things that resonate with them on an emotional level. And they don't like to pursue these things in a rational way. If they pursue it in a rational way, then it's not that elusive. Meaning should not be that elusive. Of course, it would have to be to discover what the purpose is. You can't invent meaning, because that's something which is part of your existence. It's either there or it's not there. That is to say, the meaning is a result of the fact that you're achieving your purpose. So if you're achieving your purpose, so that's the meaning. The meaning of life is to achieve one's purpose. The only thing is that most people haven't got a clue as to what their purpose is. So they sort of, it's really, they inverse it. So that which makes me happy, or that which appeals to my imagination, that it will make me happy, so that's what's meaningful. What's meaningful is my fantasies. So they accord meaning to a fantasy. But that which really has meaning, that they treat as though it were a fantasy. It's the inversion of values. Such is the insanity of this creature called man. Now, getting back to this individual who's searching for meaning and has not found it, because they were searching for it in these crazy fantasies. Now, what often happens is that having exhausted those avenues, the instinctual, they then come upon the other set of emotions, the religious emotions. And if the circumstances are correct, at a certain point in a person's life, they're down and out. They're looking to cling to something which will restore their sense of self, their sense of importance. And there's nothing in this world that's really doing it. So then they look for something maybe from a different world, from a different planet. So then they discover Jesus loves them, something like that. That's basically what's going on over here. Of course, it has to have some reality. It has no reality, but it has reality to it because you have a church and you have other people who are caught up in the same fantasy. So if something has no meaning and it's a fantasy, but if it's a fantasy of one person, it's insanity. But if it's a collective fantasy of millions of people, then it becomes a reality. Well, the same can be true in Judaism. That is to say that if this person is Jewish and goes to a synagogue, and the rabbi is a bit charismatic and preaches ideas, and these ideas make an impact upon the person, not because they've studied the source. People don't go about it that way. Because at that moment in their life, it's very important for them that these things should be real. So let's say the rabbi's talking about truths. Olam haba, the world to come, and eternal life, and perfecting the soul, and the importance of mezuzah and tefillin. And even if the explanations don't have any logic to them, that's not what counts. What counts is that at this point in the person's life, these ideas are extremely important to them from an emotional point of view and give them a sense of comfort. That's what they'll say. People today will say they chose conservative Judaism because it gives them a sense of comfort, which Orthodoxy does not, or vice versa. No, I feel that the rituals are very important. They're very important to me. And, that's what gives me the sense of comfort. So then they'll say, then I discovered the sublimity of the Shabbos, which I never saw before. It's not talking about an intellectual discovery. It's talking about something else. Again, the ultimate criterion in the mind of these peoples is not the objective truth of what they're involved in, but the impact that it has upon their emotions, how it makes them feel. So that is the same. That's Emunah Pshuta, in my opinion. All of that is Emunah Pshuta. And that is that the need is the cause of the belief. Because I need this very badly, I believe in it, and it must be true. Because truth is purely subjective. So because I feel, because I believe in this so powerfully, so therefore it has reality to it. And that's the concept of faith, that faith needs no justification. It's a very arrogant kind of a concept, that faith needs no justification. It means to say, because of me, everything revolves around me. Because I need it, and because I feel this way, and because it satisfies my needs, so therefore it's real. There are two different forms and manifestations of so-called emunah pshuta, simple faith. Simple faith, in my opinion, is a complete negation of Judaism. Other than, of course, when the individual is young, when he's a child. Of course, you raise him in the pathways of Torah. And according to his level, you give him simple explanations, which are in line with the true explanations. However, you don't do anything which is going to retard his intellectual growth and to keep him fixated intellectually at the level of acceptance of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old for the rest of his life. What you want to do is to create the best possible environment on the emotional plane and on the intellectual plane so that when he's more mature and sophisticated, he'll be able to verify the truth of those things that he has accepted without questioning since youth. So we're not saying that we forego transmission of the system to children. We're not saying that. Doesn't mean that you wait until he's an adult and then you'll start talking to him. That would be absurd. Because that also has its dangers. You've got something wonderful that you want to transmit, because this is the truth. But the education of a child in a system of objective truth, where at the end of the day, it's essential that he should investigate, he should understand, and he should make the choice because of intellectual reasons, that calls for a completely different approach. It's not simplistic. It doesn't mean indoctrination. Of course, it doesn't mean on the other end that you simply ignore the subject until he's an adult. Because that itself is going to have a bad impact upon him. As we know, that there is an education going on in youth, in childhood. The emotions are being drawn. The emotions are being attached. Emotional concepts and ideas and values are being formed all the time. So you don't want to just say, well, I'll just let my kid go into the general society, and then when he's 13 years old, we'll start discussing philosophy, and I'll try and train him, teach him, so that he can see for himself the truth of Judaism. That you can't do, because it's just too risky, because there is no neutrality over here. So what you want to do is to set things up, to put the child in an environment, so that as he develops, he's coming along emotionally and intellectually so that when the time comes, he will be in the most suitable situation to be able to engage in this type of an inquiry and thought process to enable him to see the truth of the system and to accept it and to choose it because his own mind has decided that this makes sense. Some of the themes in the cartoons that children watch, of course, among them is aggression. It may sound funny when an adult watches it, like Popeye the Sailor Man, and so on. You have these characters that are popping other people. It's usually a bad guy, good guy kind of theme. And but it's not because it's a... That's simply the so-called matir, the justification for the expression of the aggression. So aggression is one of the things. But it's just been pointed out that in a lot of the cartoons, they'll have something else where the cartoon figures can't get along with each other. They're being obnoxious to each other. And it seems that what it's appealing to over there is that sense of rebelliousness against authority. So it's good as a method, if a person wants to study the area, to try and categorize the different types of either cartoons and films or whatever it is that are being marketed to little children. And just, you don't have to be an expert on every nuance, but just get a general idea of what it's appealing to. Here we see that it's appealing to rebelliousness. The question arises, so is it bad for the child to see these cartoons where the characters are acting out their rebelliousness? Well, what if the child begins to emulate that? As being pointed out, so then the parent steps in and disciplines the child that this is something they can't do. So what happens after that? The child recognizes that there are two different worlds. And I think that's very true. Every child at a certain point is going to recognize that they live in the world of fantasy, and then there is another world called the world of reality. Well, the child has dreams at night, and the child doesn't have to be that old. I don't know at what point the child begins to recognize that the difference between the dream and the waking state. And pretty soon, when the child watches TV, the child knows that's not reality. The child knows that animals don't talk and do things like that. And then, every so often, if the child tries to pull something, when the child is emulating it, it's trying to express the fact that maybe that is reality. Maybe I can make that my reality. But then if the parent intervenes and disciplines the child, so they know that it's not. Now, one can argue that there's some beneficial aspect to these things and that the child is learning to differentiate between reality and fantasy. Now, if that's the case, you cannot deprive the child of fantasy. It's inevitable due to the nature of the human being that the human being goes through a process of development that you have to allow it to indulge certain things which are appropriate to its stage, which, when it reaches full maturity, will say is not how obviously an adult that's completely involved in fantasy the whole time has got a problem. But for a child, that's normal. You have to recognize that. The only thing, of course, is when we have to recognize those things that will have the effect of producing a lasting harm in the psyche of the child. There's where censorship comes in. But there is no way you're going to prevent the child from indulging fantasies. That's just an impossibility. And as I've just pointed out, it's a good thing that the child gets to know the world of reality as well and begins to differentiate. That's a very important lesson for anybody, and especially as an adult, because adults still have their dreams, their desires, their fantasies. And a very, very important tool for any adult is the ability to be able to differentiate and say, stop dreaming, think realistically. So, given that that's the case, as a general rule, I don't see anything wrong with these kinds of media, these kinds of movies, that obviously are based upon things that don't exist. Bear in mind that it's natural that since you're dealing with man, who's a creature that reaches maturity after a lengthy period of development, that at every developmental stage, it's going to be attached to things that do not represent the ultimate ideal, which in a sense it's false. This is not really the good, but the child will be attached to it. And that's something that educators have to make use of. The Rambam points this out in his introduction to Perek Chelek, chapter Chelek, where he says that the ultimate goal, of course, of Torah is that one should study Torah purely for the enjoyment of Torah, for no other reason, Torah Lishma. However, he says that it's impossible to train the child with that method. That is, if you're going to tell the child that he should study Torah because Torah is the greatest good, you're going to be a complete failure. No child will ever study Torah on that basis because it is impossible for a child to relate to that. So therefore, what do? You take those things at that developmental stage with which the child views as the good. So when the child is very little and it likes little candies as treats, so you use that as the incentive. Then it gets more sophisticated, so it wants to play games, play ball. You use that. And then it gets even more sophisticated and it likes things like clothing. So you tempt the child with that. Then honor. He says even honor. You tell the child, learn, because you'll be a scholar, you'll be a respected rav. All this until the individual reaches a level where they don't need these extraneous things and they're able to relate to the idea that Torah itself is the greatest good. But you see from that you're dealing with a being who goes through development. And you must utilize those things that are consequential to the individual at that particular point in his life in order to propel him to the next level. You have to work within the system of the emotions. You have to work with that, and within that system you have to draw him into the world of ideas and knowledge of truth. When you're talking about things like a Superman fantasy or Batman and Robin, that is, the superheroes that can transcend the laws of nature, that's a very powerful fantasy for a child. A child feels constrained by reality. So the idea of being able to overcome reality, especially to a child, because a child is not just constrained, the child doesn't even have freedom to make his own choices. He's constrained by his parents as well. Thus, the attraction to these beings who seemingly can transcend reality. But I don't know that there's a danger, because the child's going to grow up and outgrow that idea. No adult is going to walk around believing in Superman. So I don't know that that is so much of a problem. I think that later on in life, when the child becomes more realistic about heroes, in other words, the idea is a fantasy. However, there's more reality, more credence given to it when you look for cultural heroes to idolize. And children will do that, whether it's in sports, and then whether they get older, it's rock stars. They're looking for someone upon whom they can project this image of of a being. What's appealing is that these people are sort of above the law, that they're not limited by the rules, and so forth. Well, then it does become a problem. As the individual gets older and it's less fantasized. As I said, you see, when it's younger and fantasized, so it's true that the Superman is someone who's this hero who can fly, who can suspend all the laws. The laws of nature are suspended. It may be more extreme in that form, but precisely because of that, it's not something that's going to last. Because as the reality principle develops, everybody knows it's a fantasy. Even kids watching it and enjoying it don't believe. I mean, that's the suspension of the reality principle. However, when it becomes more realistic, so to speak, the idea itself is just as crazy, but it's found a base in reality where this person is a tremendous sports hero and he can do all these things. So you're projecting the fantasy, but it's in an arena where it has much more reality to it. Then it becomes more consuming to the child, much more consuming. And there's the factor of identification and the desire to emulate and be like that. That's where it becomes more of a significant kind of a challenge. And are you going to stop that? Are you going to eliminate that? That is to say, that the child will grow up in an environment where you won't have sports and heroes and that type of thing. I think that's pretty much impossible. Even if you eliminate it in the home, it's in the culture. The child is going to play ball. That's going to be competition. Winning, losing, the child's going to know about the Yankees, the Mets, and whatever. It's in the society. It permeates the society. You read a newspaper. I don't know that these things in and of themselves are to be prohibited and banished, and then you won't have any problems. I just don't think so. I think that there too, the intelligent parent won't prevent the child from playing ball and watching baseball and so forth. But again, it's the attitude. I mean, the important thing is the child is able to distinguish. Yeah, that's a game. And even if they cheer and yell and whatever, they feel great if their team won. But, you know, a couple hours later, they realize it's just a game. And what's our philosophy of life? So the child's going to be living in two different worlds. Let's take a teenager, let's say a 13 or 14-year-old, and where you have a good learning situation. The child enjoys learning, is really developing, questioning, analyzing, likes to discuss philosophy and hashkafa and other areas of learning, and also likes to watch baseball and gets excited with his team, roots, and all that. Again, you can have the same phenomenon where the child is going to be living in two different worlds, the world of reality and the world of fantasy. That's going to be there. You're not going to eliminate that. However, the goal is, if the education is correct, that as the child gets older, so then he's veering more and more and more towards the world of reality. And that's where he's not just in terms of what he acknowledges, but where he derives his enjoyment. And the other thing he recognizes is just a game, it's just a fantasy. And he may partake, obviously there must be some identification, but it's not where that is a serious danger, because he can differentiate between the world of reality and the world of fantasy. So that's a key factor over here. You can't eliminate, there's no way to eliminate this, and I don't know even if it would be advisable, because the creature is a creature of fantasy and reality. That's what man is, a creature who lives in two different worlds. So your goal is more and more to strengthen that part of the child which recognizes truth and knowledge and ideas, the reality part. But you've got to be very, very careful, because you got to watch, you know, the emotions. You don't want any problems. If you're going to repress the child too much and try and impose too much when the child is not ready for it, that's not going to be helpful. You've got to put the child in a good environment where it's like, you know, where you're tending a garden, so to speak, to keep away negative influences, to give it positively, to let it grow, but basically to let it grow. And we should be able to identify really bad influences. That's what we should be looking for. You should be looking for two things, I would say, in the choice of the entertainments, of these types of movies. What I would look for is, of course, first of all, to eliminate the negative. I'll give a little bit more on the negative in a minute. But even you can accelerate the positive, because if you can find interesting, you know, movies, etc., the fantasy, but they do contain things that one can talk about, child can learn from. If you can combine something adventurous which also contains knowledge that the child could benefit from, well, that's good. In terms of the negative, obviously you want to keep the child away from harmful stuff. Harmful stuff would be propaganda. I mean, study what the Nazis did, the kind of stuff they tried to embed in the child, and that's the kind of stuff that's bad. Stuff that has a message that is designed to implant false ideas. Well, you know, I'm not saying you should watch it, but basically this would be what the Christians do about Jesus, even when the kid's young. So things that have a message, if it has a message, then it's dangerous, because invariably it's going to be a bad message. Propaganda. Stuff with a message. Stuff which really doesn't have a message other than that it caters to certain fantasies is in a different category. As I said, I may be wrong on this, but I don't see what's going to be harmful. Kids watch Superman or Captain Video. I mean, it's always a different kind of thing in different generations, where you have this hero who's able to save the day. Now, unless he represents evil, I mean, in the in the past, when I was a kid, all these heroes always were, so to speak, on the side of good, fighting evil people, fighting against evil, and saving people, coming to the rescue, that kind of thing. So, because there had to be some justification for the hero figure. The hero figure always had to have a moral quality. I don't know if that's present anymore, because you're living in an amoral world. To the extent that it's not a big deal in movies now that the hero is the one who outfoxes the police and gets away with it. And when I was a kid, the theme always was that good triumphs in the end. And the good guys won, and the bad guys are defeated. That's not true anymore, because you have a different morality today. But I'm just talking in general terms, that type of thing, I don't see what's wrong with. Because the kid is not going to believe that when he gets older that that's true. He's going to recognize that that was fantasy. And as I said before, part of the development of the child is he's going to recognize the difference between reality and fantasy. And that's a good thing to have, that ability. And when he tries to overstep the bounds, well, that depends if you're a good parent. If you're a good parent and you know how to discipline a child, that's a good lesson that the child will get, not to overstep the bounds. That you just crossed over the boundary between what's permissible to fantasize about but not permissible to act on. Questions being raised with regard to certain movies where, I think it's Pokemon it's being mentioned, and what happens is that there's this hero, and everybody loves the hero, and at some point the hero dies. And everybody's extremely sad. And they get together, and they have this tremendous desire or wish, whatever it is, that the, and they have this love. So this love causes some type of a force or a beam or whatever to hit the, make contact with the one who was killed, and it resurrects, comes back to life. Now, it seems to me that it is catering to something very powerful in the psychic makeup, and that is the denial of reality, the denial of death, and more so the overestimation of the power of one's wishes. And we have just discussed that, that is at the base, at the root of the idea of cursing, that the prohibition against cursing is... The phenomenon of cursing is rooted in the sense that if one wishes something enough, it can come about. Even something which is destructive of others, which is really the expression of man's, the ultimate expression of man's primitive narcissism. And I said, along those lines, that I think it's not a good idea to encourage children, when they have a birthday party, to blow out the candles and make a wish. Because you're actually encouraging them to believe that because they wish for something, therefore it might happen. However, on the basis of everything we've said in this discussion, you could ask the question, what's worse, watching that kind of a movie or having a birthday party where the kid blows out the candles and makes a wish? Now, I've made the point that children are going to engage in the indulgence in certain fantasies. And that in and of itself, that is not so bad, because there's a saving mechanism, the ability of the child to recognize the difference between fantasy and reality. As long as it doesn't cross through, as long as the child is not encouraged to act that out in the world of reality, so then a child can recognize that that's not true. Because that's what how do parents know to tell their child that it's not true? If a child comes to you and says, Mommy, is that really true? Because if that's true, then when Grandpa, when he died, why can't we do the same thing and we'll bring him back? So what would the parent say? The parent will explain that that's not really the way things work in reality. That was just expressing an idea that we wish that because we loved them enough, we could bring him back. But then you see reality would come in. So therefore, in and of itself, the fact that a child sees that in a movie doesn't seem to be that bad to me, because it's not affecting the reality principle. What's worse then is when you encourage the child. When you have a birthday party, and you have a birthday cake, and there's 8 candles because you're 8, and you blow out those candles and you make a wish and you encourage the child to do so, you're tampering with the kid's reality principle. And you're telling him that, hey, this thing really works in the world of reality. And that, of course, is where it's dangerous. Because there are many, many people that actually live their lives that way, and they will take crazy kinds of risks in life and engage in many harmful behaviors. You see that they'll... Isn't this what they're saying? When they have the marriage breaks down. And everybody knows that, you know, we pointed out to you that you shouldn't have got, you didn't know the person well enough, you took a risk. Yeah, I know, but I believe so strongly. So basically, people make tremendous mistakes because they believe so strongly in something that it denies the reality, and then they were convinced that love conquers all. It has to, what do you mean love conquers all? That it's the same thing, because that's what I want. So my fantasies conquer all reality. You do see that this is a powerful thing. It's something that everybody has to deal with, but it has to do with maturity. Now, I'm not sure that the elimination of the movie, that the movie is the real problem over here. Of all the different forces that contribute to this type of an attitude, to an immaturity, that the person never really fully overcame that phase of life and matured to the point where the person recognizes the difference in all areas and learns to live in accordance with reality and does not allow their fantasies, the fact that they believe in something or want something so badly, that therefore they're going to prepare to simply negate all the realities here and just follow the dream. That, in my opinion, has more to do with the failure of the education. And the child was pampered. The fact that it's worse when parents are always catering to that wish and allowing the child to live in that world by allowing the child not to face consequences. Whenever something goes wrong, they just step in and forget about it and don't have to worry. Daddy made it better for you, or mommy made it better for you. When you're raising the child in a manner that gives a certain credence to that false approach, that I can get away with anything because somebody will always come in and solve things for me. So then you're teaching the child that they really don't have to deal with reality. Those types of things, it seems to me, are more harmful than watching this movie or watching the other movie. Not to discount, I'm not saying that we shouldn't even bother looking at the movies, because I'm telling you that there are bad movies. There are movies that contain a message, a specific message that will linger. This kind of thing, however, is, I think, generic. There are certain generic themes. All children are going to believe in that, pretty much. They're all going to believe in the idea of wishful thinking. That's part of the psychic makeup of a child, the overestimation of wishes. You're not going to stop that, and the child will go through a phase in which it will believe that there's credence to that. I would say that your objective is to educate the child. As the child gets older, it will begin to realize that it's not the wishes as much as there's a reality principle out there. There's reality. And to deal with reality. And the more you learn to deal with reality, that's the education. So it's not so much a movie that the child sees. Because when the child sees a movie, it does, as I said, it's always going to be helped. The child will be protected. The child's always going to be protected by the fact that the child knows that there's a difference between movie and reality. When it begins to get the same message from reality, and reality at this stage is how the parents treat it, that's where the harm comes in. As long as the parents make it clear that that's very nice, but that's the movies, that's not how things work in this world, that's not how things work in this household, so then the child is getting educated properly. And it will relegate that to a different realm called fantasy. And it'll differentiate between fantasy and reality. The harm is done by the parents, who themselves are affected by these fantasies. And they feel deprived because they didn't have it when they were children. They're trying to recreate this fantasy life in the life of the child. That's where the parents are the ones who mess up the child. That's why they encourage the child to make a wish. Okay? And if they can, if they can find out what the wish is, then the next morning the kid wakes up and under the pillow that wish is there. So they're trying to impress upon the child that you can live this way. It's the parents that are really messing up the child, because they are dissatisfied that they didn't get enough of that, you know, in their life. That, I think, is the real harm. I'm sort of recapitulating now because I think it's important. I'm not saying that you don't have to censor the media, the movies and all that. You do. And if you see something that's particularly objectionable, of course. And what I consider objectionable is that which has a lasting message, which you'll then have to deal with. You're going to have to uproot that from the child later on. But the other category, as I said, is pretty much general stuff. It's generic. The children have aggression. That's part of their life. And children have fantasies. Children have rebelliousness. That's why these cartoons are appealing to them. They like that, and they identify with the characters. And that's the reason why they can watch these characters, where it's a mouse that's trapping the cat, you know, that kind of thing. And that's very good for, because the child identifies with the mouse, because he doesn't have the power. And the cat is probably the parents. So it's an outlet. You can understand why children like that. In and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that. Children need that outlet. There's satisfaction. The point is, though, as I said, what's important to bear in mind is that the child is protected, because at the same time while this is happening, the child is learning about reality, and it's inevitable that the child has to live in two worlds. The child has to live in the world of fantasy and in reality, and the younger they are, the more the fantasy. It's the more the fantasy life. That's the real world for them. And little pieces of reality are starting to seep through. As they get older, more reality. And you got to be aware of that. And you can't impose too much reality. But the biggest problem in all this, in my opinion, is that the agenda of the parent to impose its own fantasy life. Because it's feeling frustrated that it had to abandon its fantasy life for reality. And it tries to impose that on the child. And therefore, it's harmful to the child, as we've pointed out. That, I think, is the most significant thing. And even if you sort of make a mistake, and you show them, you let them see a movie, which maybe they shouldn't have seen, but that could be corrected if the parent is intelligent and explains to the child put that in the fantasy compartment, the department, and it's not the real. And that very notion, as the child grows up, to strengthen that part of the child that recognizes reality, and to inform the child and to reinforce that fantasy is something which, that's all it is. It's just fantasy. It has no reality. That's the importance in educating the child.